We continue the shearing in a minute. Ymir says that there will come a time when a shear comes that the Jews will not accept Gerim, and they will not accept converts. Just as converts were not accepted in the time of David HaMelech and Shlomo HaMelech, time of King David and King Solomon, they did not accept any converts then, so too when Mashiach comes, you will not accept Gerim. The reason being that in order to accept a Ger, he has to have the proper emunah. He's got to believe that he's going into something of Kedusha, and it must be a sacrifice for him. He must join up with the Jews for the sake of the spiritual gain, not for the sake of a physical gain. When Mashiach comes, the Jews will be seen as the important individual nation on earth. Naturally, everyone will want to join them. That doesn't prove real emunah. Time for a goy to prove his true faith is when the Jews are downtrodden. When the Jews are suffering, are being persecuted, and then a goy says he believes in the Torah, he wants to be a Jew, that proves sincerity. But when the Mashiach comes, there'll be no way for it to prove his sincerity, and therefore we cannot accept him. The days of King David and King Solomon, the Jews then were at the height, the glory. That's why they could not accept Gerim. The fact that we do find in the Pasuk that King David accepted Ittai HaGitti, one convert, and that King Shlomo HaMelech accepted the daughter of Paro, princess, we converted. The reason there is that they were of royalty anyhow. They had all the glory they wanted. So they did not come to join the Jewish religion because of physical gain. Obviously, that's why they were the exceptions at that time. But ordinarily, a goy, in order to convert, must come at a time when the Jews are in the throes of suffering. When the Jews are being persecuted, when they're being harassed, when they are considered at their lowest ebb by all nations. The question is, we find two cases that would seem to contradict this. One, the case of Hillel HaZaken, when a goy came to him and said, convert me on condition that I become Kohen Gadol. That means that he wanted to have something which was a physical gain. He wanted to have the kavod of being a Kohen Gadol, to wear these special garments, and as the Gemara says, the Kohen Gadol was automatically given enough money to make him the richest person of all the Kohanim. So this meant wealth and honor. What kind of a sincerity was involved there? He didn't come and say, I want to learn the Jewish religion and become a Jew. He said he wanted to become a Kohen Gadol only. They go into the Holy of Holies to have the pleasures that a Kohen Gadol receives. Why was he accepted? Second case, too. The Gemara tells us that one time there was a student in the yeshiva who was very particular about the mitzvah of tzitzit. Even as every person has a certain mitzvah that his neshama is drawn to, one that he observes more than any other mitzvah. And this one was very much medakdik, where he took special care and pays with the mitzvah of tzitzit. At that time, one of the seashore cities, there was a zona, a woman of ill repute, who possessed such beauty that her price was 400 gold coins. So expensive was her price. This man sent her by mail 400 gold coins and made an appointment for a time to meet her. When that time came, He arrived at her home. He stood at the door. Then her maid reported, "The man who sent you the 400 gold coins has arrived." And she said, "Send him in." And she prepared 7 couches, one on top of the other with a ladder in between, a few steps, that is, going from one to the other. The first 6 were made of pure silver. The 7th one was made of gold, so that this was rising up to something which in itself was of radiant beauty. And she sat on the top one, waiting for him. He climbed up towards her. He sat next to her. Just before he was about to commit the sin, tzitzit, he did not remove. And as he bent over, a 4th tzitzit swung up and struck him in the face. He slew off and fell to the floor. She slid down after him to the floor, and she said to him, by swearing by her idol, Roman idols, "You must tell me what you saw in me that's wrong. What defect did you see in me that you rejected me? I'm curious." He said, "Nothing. There's nothing wrong. I have never seen a woman of your beauty yet. The truth is that these 4 tzitzit, 4 fringes that I have, struck me, and they appeared to me at that moment as 4 witnesses, reminding me that in the parasha, the chapter of Tzitzit in the Torah, the last pasuk, you have the words Ani Hashem Elokechem twice. Why does it say twice? Ani Hashem Elokechem, I am Hashem, your Hashem, who will punish for sins. I am also Hashem, who will reward for mitzvot." And these 4 tzitzit looked to me like each one was 2 witnesses to testify against me of this sin, if I do it, or testify the mitzvah if I don't do it. And tzitzit are so valuable to me that despite the great temptation, I refuse to succumb, to give in. This is the reason that I remove myself from your presence. So she said, "I won't let you go. I will not release you until you write down your name and your city where you live, the name of your rabbi, the name of the yeshiva where you attend." In order to get out, he wrote it down for her, and he left. Short time later, she sold all her belongings, all her wealth, divided into 3 parts. 1/3 she gave to the government as a bribe to let her go. 1/3 she divided for tzedakah to the poor. 1/3 she took with her in cash, in addition to all those beds, couches of silver and gold. She came to the yeshiva, and the Rosh Yeshiva there was, there are 2 opinions. One says it was Rabbi Meir Balanes, the other says Rabbi Chia. She came and she said to Rabbi Meir, "I want you to convert me." But Meir said to her, "You come to me to convert you? Perhaps you have someone in mind here, one of my students that you want. Your intentions are not that sincere. You're doing it because you want to marry someone." She took out the paper and she said, "Let me tell you the whole story." She told him that whatever exactly what happened and how impressed she was with the sincerity of this student and what a mitzvah means to a Jew. She was so affected by it that she wanted to change, convert, and to marry this student. The Gemara says that Meir called over the student and he said to him, "Go, and fortunate are you. This is your gain." He converted her. The Gemara says that which before was forbidden now became permissible. He had the same thing, same silver couches and golden one, same woman, but now this was permissible. This was his reward for the mitzvah tzitzit in Olam Hazeh. What reward he received in Olam Haba, the Gemara says, we cannot say. It's too high for us to even speak up. But the question is, Tosafot asks, in these two cases, we find that there was an ulterior motive. Case of Hillel, how could he convert this guy if the ulterior motive was to become a Kohen Gadol? Something which was impossible, of course. And yet he converted him. Case of this woman who came to convert, she wanted to marry the student. Tosafot answers that Hillel was great enough, Rabbi Meir was great enough to see in the future, to recognize, looking at this Ger or this Goya, that eventually in the future they become very, very deeply, sincerely religious. Therefore, they could convert them now. But an ordinary person who sees that the reason for conversion is an insincere one, no true faith, that type we do not accept as a convert. Of course, the law is that if that person was converted, they are 100% Jew. They're not accepted the chatchila, the event if it's done, they are naturally considered 100% Jewish. Jimenez says that a woman whose husband passes away or whose husband divorces her and she wants to remarry, she cannot remarry for a period of 90 days, 3 months' time. What is the reason for this length of time, this waiting period? So that in case she is pregnant, in case she has just conceived, we want to know whose child she'll give birth to. If she was allowed to marry another man a day after a divorce, or a day after her husband's, a week after her husband's passing, 30 days after, we could never know whose child it is, if it's the child of the first husband or the child of the second husband. What difference does it make? It's very important for a person to know who his father is, as a matter of yichus, his family tree. So therefore, we forbid a woman to get married until 3 months are over, because in 3 months we can always tell whether or not a woman is pregnant. If we find she is pregnant, then we know that the child is the child of the former husband. If she is not, then any child born henceforth is the child of the second husband. So the Gemara says, what about a goy and goya, husband and wife, who want to convert? And they, when they convert, the din says, the Gemara says that they must separate from each other for a period of 3 months' time before they can have a new wedding as Jews. Now, why do we have to have them separated then? There's no question about who the father is. It's the same man. The Gemara says, again, we want to know whether the child born, though the child is automatically a Jew because the mother converted. This is an unborn child. Doesn't require any conversion by himself. The woman who is pregnant, who converts, the unborn child is automatically Jewish too. Still, we want to know not just whether this child was born Jewish, but whether he was conceived as a Jew. The Zera itself, a seed, was conceived as a Jew, Biktusha, whether it was the child was conceived in a woman who was a Goya. This too is important to know about the child. The Gemara says that a man once came to Rav. Rav was the chief rabbi in Syria. They asked a sheila, a question of law. What is the din, he asked, if a goy has relations with a Jewish woman, an unmarried woman? Rav answered, the child is kasher. It's a Jewish child because the child takes after the mother. Well, this man said to Rav, fine, you have just stated a law, which means that I am kasher. That's what happened to his parents. Therefore, he said, I demand that you give me your daughter for a wife to prove that you mean this, prove this is the case. So Rav said, I refuse to give you my daughter. Rav's student was standing nearby, Rav Shini Lachia, and he said to Rav, there's a saying, people say that in Turkey, in Mordai rather, they say that they have a camel who does a dance. They take a round, a circular coin, sort of, a pot, and the camel puts all 4 feet into this narrow pot. He does a dance in that pot. Sort of a saying. Now, it's an unusual thing, but according to that saying, we have the camel, we have the pot, let's see the dance. In other words, you stated a law, we have the law. We have the man here who was born of such a case. We have him asking you to perform. Now, why don't you prove it by giving him your daughter? So Rav said, if this man was as great as Yehoshua ben Nun, student of Moshe Rabbeinu, I still wouldn't give it to him. I would give my daughter to him. Because I don't care for his attitude. So the man said to Rav, if I was Yehoshua ben Nun, then I wouldn't have to resort to asking you for your daughter. Because if you wouldn't give me your daughter, somebody else would. But as I am right now, if you refuse to give me your daughter, everyone will follow your example. I'll have no chance to marry a Jewish woman, though you say that I am a complete Jew. Therefore, he said, I insist I will not leave you until you give me your daughter. Yehuda says he was such a pest, harassing Rav so much, that finally Rav looked at him. But of course, the man felt dead immediately. One of those looks. Yehuda says that one came to Rav Yehuda, one of the students of Rav, asked the same question, am I kosher? He said, yes. But though you're kosher, most Jews will refuse to have their daughters marry you. Therefore, I advise you to go to a different city where they don't know you. They wouldn't ask for your family background. You were brought up as a Jew here. You'll come there as a Jew. You'll marry anyone you want. You'll have no problem at all. This is your only solution. Go to a place where they don't know of you, and there you can get married simply. The letter says that, question, what is required of a person to become a ger? What are the requirements? The letter says there are possibly two. One, he must have a brit milah. Two, he must have tevilah, mikveh, in order to convert. Rabbi Eliezer says that if he had just the brit milah alone, he did not have mikveh, he is still considered a ger, because we do find in the past case when the Jews left Egypt that they all had a brit milah, but they did not go to mikveh. Still, they were considered Jewish. Rabbi Yeshua says, I say that if a man had mikveh, and he was not circumcised, he is considered a ger. Proof? But we find that the mothers of the Jews, that is, the mothers in the past, women who converted, how did they become geyuret? How did they become Jewish? They went to mikveh. They did not have a brit milah. So why should a man be different? Why should a man be required to have more than a woman? So therefore, according to that reasoning, a Gish should require two things, but if he had only one, if he had just mikveh alone, he's not worse than a woman. If there is such thing as women's rights, there should be such thing as men's rights too. Men should not be required more than a woman. The Chachamim, the rabbis, argue against both, and they state emphatically, and this, of course, is the halacha. Any goy, male, who had one of the two, either brit milah alone or mikveh alone, that person is considered nothing as far as converting. He is not a ger convert until he has both brit milah and the tevilah and mikveh. The Gemara says, how do we go about converting a goy nowadays? If a person comes and wants to be converted to a ger, we speak to him. This means the rabbis speak to this goy, and they say to him, why do you want to convert? Don't you see that the Jews today are such a low level, so downtrodden, so poor, so much suffering that they've got to endure? What does it pay for you to leave a nation or a country where you have honor and come to ones who have the greatest dishonor in the world? If the goy answers, I know this to be so, and despite that, I still want to become a Jew, and I humbly feel I don't even deserve to be a Jew, then we accept him immediately, and we notify him some of the laws, some of the stricter laws, lighter laws. We do not press too hard. We don't give him all laws at one time to discourage him. But why do we tell him, why do we make it so difficult? Why do we try to dissuade him in the first place? Because we are not anxious to have Goyim convert. If this will dissuade him and he'll leave, fine, we're satisfied. Why are we not anxious to have Goyim? Why we prefer that they do not convert? Because the Gemara says that Gerim, converts, are very harmful to the Jews. They are like a leprosy to the Jews. Why? Number of reasons. First place, because they generally are not informed. They are not learned. And once they join the Jewish community, and Jews who are not learned either see these gerim in action, they see them miss out on certain mitzvot, the Jews might learn from them, be misled, and follow them and doing wrong. That's one reason. Second reason is, why are they so harmful to us? Because they are very dangerous as far as a Jew, the Jew himself being harmed from heaven, because the Torah warns with such vigor, such severity, about the treatment that is to be given to a ger. Slightest wrong word said to a ger can bring down all the punishment from heaven upon a Jew. That's why it's very dangerous to have a ger around. You might say the wrong thing to hurt his feelings, and therefore the ger is like a leprosy to a Jew. It's a danger. Another reason is that the nature is that if a goy does finally convert, then when he accepts a mitzvah, he does it with such simple, pure sincerity, such devotion, that the Jews cannot compare to it. A Jew does it out of habit. A Jew does it with not that much care. The goy treasures it. This, in the eyes of heaven, belittles the Jews. So this brings out the Jew, who until now was considered a fair type of Jew, performing mitzvot. Now, compared to this goy, the Jew looks bad. And this brings out his act as a sin rather than as a mitzvah. That's why the Jews would rather not have these gerim around to put them to shame. We also have to tell the goy about the mitzvah of tzedakah, ma'aser. You should know that there are obligations when it comes to money, because by goyim, the slightest theft, no matter what it is, even if it's less than a penny, then if he steals less than a penny, his penalty is death. Penalty for theft on the part of a goy is death, and he can't even do teshuvah. A Jew who steals a penny or more is considered a theft. He can do teshuvah by returning it. By a goy, he cannot. So he's got to know that when he becomes a Jew, if somebody steals less than a penny from him, don't go killing him. There's a new type of life. Secondly, you've got to tell him, warn him, that he is undertaking difficulties. And the wording is, we say to him, know that until now, you were free to eat taref. If you ate taref, you had no punishment. If you broke Shabbat, there was no death penalty. Now, if you eat taref, like blood or fats that's forbidden, the punishment is karet. Break Shabbat, the punishment is death, skila. But at the same time, in all fairness, we also tell him, this is the rough side of the coin. On the other hand, know that there is a tremendous reward for the mitzvot. There is a Gan Eden that is made for tzaddikim. In this generation on earth, you see the Jews suffering. That's because this is only this temporary world, which is not made for the Jews. For the Jews, there's a different world awaiting them, a world of Gan Eden of such a beauty that we can't even describe it. This, if you accept, this is in store for you. So these words, too, some words of encouragement are given to him, and then we allow him to make his own decision. We do not try to influence him in a positive manner. Yehuda says that, how come that nowadays, Gerim, when a goy converts, as a goy, he was making out fine. He was doing well. He was healthy. He made a good living. Then he becomes a Jew. We find suddenly that he loses his money, his health. The Gerim suffer a lot. The answer is, the Gemara says, because of the fact that a goy is required to obey seven mitzvot. Those seven mitzvot, generally, a goy does not obey. And the punishment for it is saved for him. Goyim have olam hazeh. They get Gehinom for failing to obey their seven mitzvot. Now that the goy has converted, we don't want a Jew to have Gehinom. So from heaven, they punish him from this world for the lack of obedience to the seven mitzvot he broke as a goy. That's why Gedim suffer. The Gemara says, Rabbi Yossi argues that point. He says, definitely not, because the fact is that a ger, a convert, the moment he converts, is just like a newborn child, which means that his past is completely erased. Anything he did in the past is completely gone and off the record. There's no such thing as paying now for the past. So, therefore, there's no punishment, no suffering for those seven mitzvot he failed to obey as a goy. Why then do we see that gerim, converts, suffer? Because of the fact that they do not know the laws, Hebrew laws, properly, and they suffer with the attempt to carry out the law. If they fail, they're not doing it properly. Now, as a Jew, they've got to pay for it. This is why Gedim, who in most cases are not learned, automatically suffer. Another reason is that a Jew is supposed to serve Hashem. He is supposed to begin serving Hashem through fear. That is unavoidable. There's no alternative to that. You cannot start in serving Hashem unless you have fear of Hashem. But you are not to remain at that level. Jew is supposed to go to a higher level. After fear, he's supposed to achieve an ahava, a love for Hashem that is so great that it'll overshadow, overpower any other type of ahava he has for other things that are wrong. He has a desire for certain physical temptations. He'll reject them because of the fact that he loves Hashem so much. This will stop him from partaking in any of the other physical desires. But a ger, most gerim, serve Hashem out of yirah, out of fear. They convert because they have this fear, deep-seated fear of Olam Haba, of Gehinom, influenced by this talk about the Gehinom by the Jews, and they remain with this point. They're afraid to commit a sin because they don't know that there is this Gehinom they were told about, this punishment. They're afraid to go back to their old freedom, old religion because of this punishment. And they remain through life with this fear. Because of this fear for punishment, because this is not a true, full serving of Hashem, therefore they suffer this fee throughout their lives. Agnes says about Manasseh, king of the Jews, son of King Chizkiyahu. Chizkiyahu was the king who was so perfect that in his time he taught Torah to all the Jews, men, women, and children. He did not want to have children, to get married and have children, because he foresaw the future he'd have children who are evil. Finally, he married the daughter of Yeshayahu, the prophet. That was after he had become ill. And he prayed to Hashem, and Hashem saved him from death and added 15 years to his life. Married the daughter of Yeshayahu Navi, and then he gave birth to two children. One of them was killed, the second Manasseh took over the kingdom and became very evil. Well, it is written that Manasseh killed a prophet Yeshayahu Navi. In addition to all the idol worship he committed, he also murdered Yeshayahu Navi. How did this come about, this murder? The Gemara says that he summoned Yeshayahu to a trial, and he acted as judge. And he said, I charge you with a crime. What crime? Against the Torah. And for this, you deserve death. One, Moshe Rabbeinu said, in the Pasuk in the Chumash, no person can see Hashem and remain alive. Yeshayahu the prophet said in his prophecy, and I saw the spirit of Hashem on the throne. Now, this is contradictory to the Torah. Second, the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu says that Mika Hashem Elokeinu v'chol kareinu elav, who is like Hashem in that any time we call upon Hashem, he will listen to us. You say that your prophecy, the Pasuk in Yeshayahu Navi, where it says, Dishu Hashem b'imatz'o, seek Hashem in a time when he can be found. There is a time he can be found, and there is a time that he cannot. Again, you contradicted the words of the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu. You deserve death for that. Third time, Moshe Rabbeinu says in the Torah that Hashem will fulfill, complete the days, the years of a tzaddik, live a complete life. This is a blessing. You will live your whole life. Yeshayahu Navi said to Chizkiyahu, the king Chizkiyahu, V'nei Hashem, I will add to your years 15 additional years. Again, you can't predict Moshe Rabbeinu. The Torah says that a tzaddik receives his full complement of life. The number of years faded for him. You said he receives more than that number of years. This is a contradiction. For these three crimes, you must pay with your life. Shianavi said to himself, I know that if I give him the answers for these three questions, he'll refuse to accept it. And he really is making a mistake. he feels that I committed three crimes. He's going to kill me for them. If I give him the answers and he refused to accept them, he'll still kill me. That means he'll be killing me deliberately. That'll be a much bigger crime. I would rather try to escape him than avoid having him commit so serious a sin as killing a prophet, killing a Jew, and especially a prophet. Shionavi said a special word of Kabbalah, one of the names of Hashem, and there was a tall cedar tree. He suddenly was removed from this place and absorbed into, he merged with the cedar tree, became part of it in the cedar tree. But Menashe detected this. He took the tree and chopped it through the middle. And of course, in chopping the tree, this murderer, he killed Chayanavi. Because he kept on chopping until he came to the part where Shinadi's mouth was, and that's where he killed him. The Gemara says, why at that point? Because at one time in his prophecy, Navi said, I am living among a nation whose mouths are tameh. He dared to speak, to defile, speak badly of the Jews, children of Hashem, even though they were sinners. This Hashem did not want of a leader. This was his penalty. Yehuda says, let's study the questions of Menashe. How are those three questions answered? The seeming apparent contradiction between Moshe Rabbeinu's words in the Chumash and Yishaya Navi's words in the Navi. First question was that Moshe Rabbeinu said no person can see Hashem and live. Shianavi said, I have seen Hashem. The answer is that difference between Moshe Rabbeinu and all other prophets is like one who sees clearly, wide awake, another who sees a vision in a haze, in a trance, a semi-sleep. So that type of vision, of course, a prophet could see. But no person can see Hashem clearly in a wide awake state. Therefore, Shianavi said, I saw Hashem in this trance. This was true. See a vision of the spirit of Hashem in a sort of a haze. Whatever that vision was, of course, he's still a prophet. We cannot interpret the meaning of what he had seen. Second item, when Moshe Rabbeinu says, call upon Hashem anytime and he will answer you. Shianavi said, seek Hashem only at a time will be found. The difference is, Moshe Rabbeinu was speaking to all the Jews, and there is a tzibur, a minyan, or a group, whole nation combined praying together, you have a tzibur, Hashem will always answer. It's always available. But a person, yachid, cannot get Hashem to answer him at all times. Only at certain times, only, is the, are the heavens open even to a yachid. That is in the 10 days of Tishu B'Av between Rosh Hashanah and Kippur. Third statement, where Moshe Rabbeinu said that Hashem completes the days of a tzaddik, and that is the biggest blessing. Yishan Ari said Hashem added years to the tzaddik, 15 years more. This itself is a machloket, a debate among rabbis of the Gemara, as to the meaning of these words of Yishaya Navi. The Chachamim say, that is, Rabbi Akiva says, that I will complete your days means a tzaddik, or any person, is given a certain number of years of life. If he is a tzaddik, then Hashem says, I'll give you your full complement of years, whatever you were fated to receive. Anything you do wrong will subtract from that number. So you must be a tzaddik to receive that full number. This is what Rabbi Akiva says. The Chachamim, the rabbis, say the contrary. It works both ways. This is your fated amount of years. If you are a tzaddik, we will add to those years, which means that Cheskiyahu the king received 15 years more than he was supposed to have. A person's esha, we will subtract from those years. So the minute it says the rabbis asked the Rabbi Akiva, how could you say that tzaddik receives only the number of years that are fated to him? The pasuk says, "Befeirush Hashem said to Chizkiyahu through the prophet, I will add to your years 15 years." The Akiva answered, didn't mean that he will add 15 years more than was fated. I will add 15 years more than is fated right now. You are about to die. I'm telling you right now, you are about to die because you were going to die 15 years before your time was up. So we're giving you now the 15 years back because of your tefillah, your intense prayer. You now have a return to 15 years which you nearly had lost. But ordinarily, no tzaddik receives more than the amount of years that are fated for him. This is the opinion of the Akiva. Chachamim, of course, say, this is what is accepted, that a person can have more years than are fated for him through certain good deeds. We find that case in the Gemara many times. Rabbi Predah, for example, who received 400 years extra life because of the fact that he was very patient with a student. Other rabbis, Sadiqim, who received many additional years. The Gemara says in the second Beit HaMikdash, the Kohen Gadol generally was not as good as the Kohen Gadol in the first Beit HaMikdash. We once mentioned first Beit HaMikdash, the Kohen Gadol lasted for many years. Second Beit HaMikdash, there were 300 Kohanim Gidolim, which means that every one of them, nearly every one, lasted for less than a year because they were that evil. Now, as an example, what was wrong? The Gemara says that Yehoshua ben Gemla, who became engaged to Marta bat Baitus, she was one of the wealthiest women in Eretz Yisrael, and she gave 3 whole bushels of coins to Yanai the king as a bribe to appoint her husband, Yeshua ben Gamla, as the Kohen Gadol. This is a sample of what the Kohanim Gadol were like in the second Beit HaMikdash. They received their position through bribery, and because of that, bribery shortens a person's life. That's why they did not last long as Kohanim. Yemina says that a person must remain married throughout life. In other words, the purpose of a wife is not just to have children. That's the first mitzvah in the Torah. That's the primary reason. But aside from that too, Yemina says that a person is evil if he lives without a wife. This means even in old age, because a wife, the fact that a wife is present, stops a person from having bad thoughts. One who is not married can have bad thoughts, bad desires, above all the thoughts that prevail. Not having where to fulfill his desire, he is beset with these bad thoughts and desires. And this goes for any age whatsoever. The pasuk in the Torah says, Lo tov heyot ha'adam levado, person. It is not good for a person to be alone without a wife. And we find that Rabbi Natanzel once spoke to someone who was not married, and he said, you are no good. Because I translate the pasuk, lo tov, no good is he who is alone. Not it is not good, but he who is alone without a wife, who is unmarried, is a person who is no good. And therefore, that is for a person to see to it to be married, and in being married, he is saved from bad thoughts. This is later years. How much more so, Abinazal says, person who is young and gets married when he is young, he is saved for the rest of his life from bad thoughts. The younger a person is when he is married, the better off he is throughout life. So that's the reason why rabbis in the past got married at a very young age. And this lesson was implanted in the hearts and minds of tzaddikim of later generations, the time of Rabbi Nazal. A standard day of marriage was a day of bar mitzvah. We do find that, too, in the time of the Gemara also. Though the Gemara says that one rabbi claimed he was married at 16, and therefore he was superior in Kiddushah to his friends. We find that Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, when he made his son, Rabbi Elazar ben Shimon's bar mitzvah, on that day, Rabbi Yossi came and offered his daughter to Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai for Rabbi Elazar's wife, and they made the Kiddushin right then. And this is one of the reasons why Rabbi Elazar ben Shimon was told.